We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. Now here's your program.
And good morning. This is hour number two of Focus. It's our morning talk show. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us this morning. We're also pleased to have here on the program once again Dr. Jeff Swearingen from Carle in Urbana, where he does family medicine. He's with us on the program every other month on a Monday. We built these shows into the rotation so that there would be a regular and predictable opportunity to talk with a physician about, well, about whatever might be concerning you. Could be something for yourself, could be something for your children or young people in your family, because Dr. Jeff does in fact see people of all ages in his practice, grown-ups, kids, sees people who have a wide range of health concerns. So this is an opportunity for you to ask general questions. Whenever we have doctors on the program, I also say right up front, you know, there are limits. We cannot, because the doctor can't see you, you know, that puts some limits on what he can do. But also, we do the programs, well, because it's a chance to ask questions and maybe get some basic information. And then you might want to pursue that with your own physician, somebody who can see you. But questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana. We have a toll-free line that is good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. And if you'd like to email your question, you can do that too. The address is will-talk. So that's just kind of like it sounds, will-talk@illinois.edu. And we'd be happy to take it that way. Thank you very much for being here.
My pleasure, David.
We were just chatting here just a little bit before we got going about hypertension, about the problem of blood pressure, and about how now, because of concerns about heart disease, I think that doctors are looking more closely at it, and maybe they're a little bit more concerned about when you see patients, you're a little bit more concerned about what those numbers are. Just talk for a moment about blood pressure, because I go in, get the blood pressure cuff on there, you know, they do the thing, and then they say, okay, and it's this and it's that. And I'm thinking, well, is that good? Is that okay? What do those numbers mean?
Well, most people are familiar with the fact that there are two numbers, the one on top being higher than the one on the bottom. That number on the top is what's referred to as the systolic pressure and represents the amount of force being generated by your heart when it actually pumps. And the bottom number, or the diastolic reading, basically represents the resting tone in the heart and blood vessels in between pumping. So that's that period of time when the heart is actually filling with blood again after it's pumped out its last little aliquot. And what we know is that if those pressures are consistently high, either the top or the bottom or both, it simply produces more wear and tear not only on the heart but also the blood vessels which share that same pressure. In the United States, the cardiovascular diseases are by far the leading cause of death. So you have your heart attacks and your strokes and your congestive heart failure. And these things have all been directly tied to problems with high blood pressure. And it, to a certain extent, it's somewhat proportional. The higher your blood pressure, the more likely you are to have a problem. But even relatively slightly high blood pressures over a long period of time generate more wear and tear on the heart and blood vessels and basically cause them to wear out sooner. One of the analogies that's frequently used, high blood pressure is like the story of the guy sitting in his car with the engine running. He's got the car in park, but he's got his foot on the accelerator. He's not going anywhere. But he's generating an awful lot of wear and tear on that engine and all those moving parts. And, you know, if you compare him to the person who doesn't have their foot on the accelerator, his car is going to basically wear out sooner. You know, it'll run fine for a while. But it's the cumulative wear and tear over time. And that's one of the problems with high blood pressure. For the most part, it doesn't hurt. So people think, well, you know, how important can it be? And in fact, it's the wear and tear that it puts on the heart and the blood vessels that ultimately catches up with people. And so there has been more emphasis on trying to identify people whose blood pressure is up. There are a number of lifestyle ways of treating high blood pressure, certainly weight loss, restricting salt in the diet, trying to become physically more active. All of these things will benefit your heart and your blood vessels, primarily by lowering your blood pressure. And so this is something that if people have been told that their blood pressure is a little high, that they can work on. In many instances, however, the tendency toward high blood pressure is often an inherited condition. And some people, even if they do all the right things, may in fact end up with high blood pressure, and that's where there are a variety of medications that can be used to help bring it back down into the normal range. And there are excellent long-term studies that have shown time and time again that if you bring somebody's blood pressure down into the normal range and keep it there, their risk of all of those cardiovascular problems is significantly reduced. So there's excellent data for that. And that's why there's probably been a bit more emphasis on trying to recognize even milder forms of high blood pressure. In the past, the number 140 for the top and 90 for the bottom was pretty much the cutoff. You know, if you were below that, that was probably fine. If you were above that, that was probably a little too high. Those numbers are getting kind of pushed downwards as they look at more and more at the data, showing that basically the lower you can get those numbers, the lower your cardiovascular risk. So even people with blood pressures of 135 over 85 still have slightly higher cardiovascular risks than those who, say, are less than 120 over 80. So there's now this sort of push to recognize people who are in that kind of borderline area and try and make them aware of that and start to make some changes to hopefully bring those down into the normal range.
And then though for those people, you'd be looking at, you certainly wouldn't be starting off thinking about medication. You'd be looking at their, all those lifestyle things.
Correct. Because, you know, one of the problems with the average American diet is that the salt content is already extremely high. Mm. It's estimated that there's probably 10 to 20 times the amount of sodium in the average American diet than what your body actually needs. We just like the taste of salt, so we put it in everything because it makes things taste better. So simply cutting back on the sodium content of one's diet can be a real good start. Losing weight is very much helpful, and exercise.
Yeah. It's tough with the sodium because it would be easy if you were making everything yourself. But the problem is that pre-packaged processed foods have a lot of sodium in them. Even from my experience, even things that they say that they're low in sodium, they still have a lot of sodium.
Yes.
And I know it's something I think maybe the food industry is starting to address, or at least starting, they say that they are. So maybe that we can work on that. But so many packaged products, they're just loaded with sodium.
That is exactly right.
We have a couple callers here. Dr. Jeff Swearingen is our guest. And if you have health questions, you give us a call. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. You may also email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. We have a couple people here ready to go, and we'll start with Champagne and line one. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. Actually, I'm calling with a happy ending story to something that you gave me some advice on with regard to my 4-year-old son, who at the time was having trouble having bowel movements in the toilet.
Oh, yes.
He'd do everything else. You know, but he wouldn't do that, and he'd go into the bathroom, poop in his diaper, and come out, and it was going on and on and on. And so I called in, and we talked about it for a few minutes, and you used the phrase, you know, age-appropriate behavior, and suggested there might be, you know, potentially sort of an emotional reason or psychological reason for why he was doing this, because it was obviously not physical. And that scared me to death. So that night, I sat down with him and I showed him his baby book and I said, look, you were a baby, you couldn't walk and now you can walk. And first, look, you know, you couldn't run and now you can run, and showed him all the things he had learned to do as he got bigger and bigger. And And now you know how to make pee-pees in the potty, and you know how to make poopies, and then you can make them in the potty. And he seemed, like, kind of comforted by this and sort of like, oh, I'm getting older and it's fine. You know, I'm still, you know, my mom and papa still love me even though I'm getting bigger and doing more things. So that night he woke up in the middle of the night, went to the bathroom, pooped in the toilet, and went back to sleep. And when he woke up, he said, I said, you made a poopy in the potty last night. He said, no, I didn't. I did not. So the next night, same thing. He woke up, pooped in the toilet, went back to sleep. And the next morning, he said, you made a poopy in the potty last night. He said, I know, I did. And literally, that we have not had a single accident, not a single time has he gone back. It was like one day to the next. That was it. He's done. We're done. So I just wanted to thank you. It made a huge difference.
I think you handled that very, very well.
Well, he really, I mean, it was worth the wait because we didn't have any of those things of like, I might not get there in time. I mean, he was old enough to just be ready and be done. And I just wanted to let you know that that worked out well. And thank you for your advice.
Well, you're very welcome. I'm glad to hear it.
It's great. Well, okay. That's excellent to have a success story. It makes me think about how, you know, for a long time, for many years, we had a pediatrician, Dr. Robert Bocek, mm-hmm. was here on the program regularly. And one of the things that we talked a lot about was toilet training. And he always used to say, you know, I'm not even sure I like the word training, because he said that you really have to think more about developmental readiness,
right.
You know, that there are certain things that have to, and everybody's on a different schedule. And so that it's not so much that you teach somebody to do that. It's they do it when they're ready.
And one of the things that I talk to about with the parents in my practice is that toileting issues should never become a matter of who's in charge. If it becomes a control issue,
you're going to lose. You're gonna lose.
The parents cannot win because the kid can go, huh, hey, guess what? and so you're correct. It should always be approached positively with recognition of where the child is physically and emotionally in terms of their readiness to, you know, partake of this particular process. But if it becomes who's in charge, man, that gets ugly in a hurry.
Yeah.
But the caller calling back kind of reminded me of one of the other WILL shows that's also a call-in program, which is Car Talk, where they have the people that they gave advice to call them back in a couple weeks and say, did we get it right? Exactly. So I was glad to hear we had
Stump
some positive.
The chumps.
Exactly. That's the one.
You're right. Okay. Well, we're happy to have questions, of course. And if you got some advice that was good, hey,
we'd love to hear that.
333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu, and we'll talk next with someone in Urbana. Hello.
Is it my turn?
Yes.
I'm calling about ulcerative colitis and irritable bowel syndrome. And my son seems to have developed this condition. And so I think that he's depressed, and I think that's a big part of the problem. And I'm reading about this, the colitis, and it seems the only cure is to have surgery to remove the colon, rectum, and anus. And I just feel very terrified by that. And I wonder what can be done, what can I tell him that can be done to get him better and not have to have this kind of surgery.
Well, your question is a good one, but there are a couple of things we're going to have to clarify. You mentioned two distinctly different diagnoses.
Mm-hmm.
Ulcerative colitis and irritable bowel syndrome are not the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in the sort of olden days, irritable bowel syndrome was often referred to as colitis, which raises some confusion when people start talking about things. But there is a very distinct pathologic process in the colon. It's an inflammatory illness, and it's referred to as ulcerative colitis.
And it's
treated with medications and, as you correctly point out, sometimes surgical resection of that portion of the colon that is affected with the disease. But irritable bowel syndrome is not a disease that requires any type of surgery and is what we call a functional problem. The anatomy associated with the colon is, in fact, normal, but it just doesn't work correctly and often produces symptoms of either constipation or diarrhea or cramping, which many people find, unpleasant and uncomfortable, but in and of itself is not medically harmful. Now, people who have ulcerative colitis can, in fact, become quite ill and lose weight, and they can have a number of medical problems related to their illness. So before we can discuss your son in particular, you need to define for sure which particular medical problem you're talking about.
Well, he seems to have both kinds of symptoms. For the irritable bowel syndrome and then also for the colitis.
Okay. Has he had a colonoscopy?
Yes, he did.
And did biopsies confirm ulcerative colitis?
I think so, yes.
Okay. Then in all likelihood, most of his symptoms would probably be related to ulcerative colitis. It would be unusual to have irritable bowel on top of that.
Well, he gets constipated sometimes.
Mm-hmm. And fluctuations in bowel function can be seen with both conditions. You're correct.
So what can I tell him to help him?
The non-surgical approaches to ulcerative colitis usually represent medications given to reduce inflammation in the colon. And there are a fair number of medications that are now available to help normalize the levels of inflammation in the colon, which when those come down, the symptoms usually resolve as well.
Okay, so there is some kind of medication that could help the colitis.
Very much so.
And that would be the best route to go.
That would be the first route to go before considering anything like surgery.
Oh, my God, that just terrifies me to think about all that surgery. It sounds awful to lose your whole colon.
Well, it's a very big procedure, yes, but is usually reserved for those individuals who have essentially failed their trials of medication.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Well, is there anything else you could tell me then?
I think that would be a good place to start.
Just the medication.
Yes.
All right. Well, thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Our guest in this part of Focus is Dr. Jeff Swearingen. He's a family medicine doctor at Carl in Urbana and is on the program here every other month, always on a Monday, to talk about general health issues. And if you have some questions, you can call us and he'll see if he can help you out. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455, and email will-talk@illinois.edu. We had somebody here who asked their question off the air, and it seems fairly simple and straightforward, and they're wondering about generic medications for lowering cholesterol. And what they're asking is, do the generics work as well as the name brand medications?
For the most part, I would say yes. The individual patient can have just that, an individual response to different medications. In many instances, the brand name medications are better advertised, so people recognize them and, will end up talking to their physician about, something they saw on TV like Lipitor. But there are, in fact, generic medications in the same general chemical class, which are perfectly reasonable to try. In many instances, people are asked by their insurance companies to try the generically available ones first, simply because they're less expensive than the brand name preparations. If somebody does well with a generic medication, it's effective, it's well tolerated, there's really no advantage to then switching to a brand name product. Occasionally we will run into somebody who says, well, you know, I've tried this generic and that generic and it either didn't work for me or I didn't tolerate it. And we will then, if they still need something for their cholesterol, switch to a brand name product, not necessarily because it's automatically better, but just different. And so in most instances, it's not so much the medication as it is the person who's taking it.
Yeah. And there's this sort of mystery about how it is you can give the same medication to 10 people or 20 people and they're going to have different experiences. For some people, it'll work fine. Some people maybe have some problems with it. And
that's what makes life interesting because everybody is different.
Different, mm-hmm. Okay. And within certain classes of medications, two different companies can put out medicine and it can be different enough so that they can call it something different, but that as far as, say, you're concerned, they're supposed to be, functionally, they're supposed to be the same, right. But there again, one person could, one of them could work better for one person, another could work better for another person, and you kind of don't know until you try.
And then that's exactly right. And in many instances, when people first begin the medication, that's what is referred to as a trial of medication, one to see, does the person tolerate it well, because that's obviously important. Two, is it effective? And three, when you do your laboratory testing, are there any other biochemical markers of intolerance? And so if somebody says, this works fine for me and their laboratory work looks good, then there really isn't any reason to change to something else. But if somebody says, I don't feel well taking it, or it's not effective, or it's causing some other abnormalities, then switching to something else is certainly quite reasonable.
To someone on a cell phone, line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I have a couple of questions. One is regarding irritable bowel syndrome. Can irritable bowel syndrome be improved if a person takes the rough fiber, like psyllium seed stuff?
In many instances, the colon and intestinal tract in general functions best when there's a certain amount of fiber in our diet. Now, that's going to vary from person to person to how much that is, but in many instances, anything that provides more bulk to the stool is something that makes it easier for the colon to function.
Yeah.
So in general, the answer is yes.
It wouldn't hurt the situation. There's no possibilities of it necessarily hurting the situation?
No, but I do tell people, if you're not used to fiber and then you all of a sudden take a whole bunch all at once, you're going to feel gassy and bloated and distended, and you're going to say, gee, that was terrible. That didn't help at all. So
kind of ease into it?
Exactly. What I tell people is, try a little bit and then wait a week or so and try a little bit more, give yourself and your system a chance to accommodate to getting used to something that wasn't, obviously part of their natural diet in the past. But yes, most people who do it slowly will accommodate that very well and do find it to be effective.
The other question is regarding diabetes and blood sugar testing.
Mm-hmm.
If you have low, you have medium, okay blood sugar for a while, and then either on purpose or inadvertently you have a real high reading, and then you go back down to normal, and that happens a couple of times, maybe during the 3-month period. And during that time, you also have extra low ones. Do those balance out, the high and the low, when at the end of 3 months you get those urine tests?
I'm not sure I know what urine test you're referring to.
Well, I go to the doctor every 3 months, and I have my, I don't know what they call it, but it's tested, and they are able to tell if I'm below 0.7 or 7. That's my goal, or I'm not sure what it was. But
okay, what you're referring to is called a glycosylated hemoglobin, or A1C test.
Yeah.
And that's a blood test.
Right, and I was wondering if if I have a 50, a few times during that three-month period, and I have 223 times during that period. Do those cancel each other out, or what? That's what I'm trying to figure out.
Okay. The blood test referred to as an A1C is a test that generates a number that tells your physician how well have your blood sugars been controlled over the last 2 to 3 months.
Right.
And so it's basically just that, an average. So you're to some extent, you're correct. They do sort of average out.
Yeah.
If your blood sugars are consistently high, even if there's an occasional low one in there, but if they're in general consistently high, then your A1C number is going to be above 7.
Yeah. And well, last time it was below 7. But
and that's where we're shooting for.
Yeah, every once in a while it happens. You know, you go to grandma's and there's extra dessert, and you don't refuse it, and all of a sudden you're weak.
Well, okay. The key in terms of blood sugar is what we tell folks is, you know, what you do occasionally, you know, once every 3 weeks, once every 4 weeks, is probably not going to hurt that overall average, because it's going to take 2 to 3 months to change that number.
Okay.
So it's pretty much what you do consistently, as opposed to occasionally going to grandma's.
Okay, and I guess the other question is, is it better to have lower? Well, they're not supposed to be too low. I mean, it's like 60 or something. Is it better to be the low side, or they're after? Well, I guess what I'm trying to say is somebody told me that if you go too low, you can get brain damage.
If your blood sugar at a particular moment in time is in fact too low, yes, it is quite harmful. People seize, they become unconscious. It can in fact cause damage.
Right.
So, in terms of when you check a fasting blood sugar, if you're not diabetic, we normally expect a number somewhere between 60 and 100. And if you are diabetic, to the extent that you keep your blood sugars, you know, above 60, you shouldn't run into any problems in terms of causing any kind of damage. In fact, you know, that would be excellent control. It's
okay.
Just typically hard to get there if you're diabetic.
I've managed so far.
Good.
Thank you very much.
All right.
Very helpful.
Thank you.
Thanks.
And we'll go to another caller. This is someone in Bloomington, Illinois. Line number 2. Hello.
Hi, this is Bloomington.
Yes.
I have a question for you about blood pressure.
Sure. Go ahead.
You hear me?
Yes.
Okay. I may have a little bit of history with high blood pressure, and I've been taking my readings every couple days or so. And what I've noticed is that the high number is consistently, well, frequently higher than normal. It's usually around in the 145 area. But the low number is lower than 80. And I wonder if that means anything particular, or why would I get a low number on the low side, and on the high number it's well above normal.
Mm-hmm. And what you're referring to, if that's a consistent finding, is something that is commonly recognized in the medical community as isolated systolic hypertension. This tends to occur more commonly as we get older, and there are medications that are specifically targeted to impact the systolic reading more than the diastolic reading. So there are ways to adjust for that. But you point out a fairly, you know, common situation. We have people where the top number is too high, but their bottom one is okay. And then in other instances, both the top and the bottom number are too high. But in this particular case, it's still worthwhile to try and normalize that top number, because it represents the amount of work that your heart's doing to pump blood. And to the extent that you can make that easier, you take some of the wear and tear and pressure off the heart.
Okay. That low number is just a resting. It's a resting number, right?
That is correct.
Okay. You say there's a specific, some specific prescription that are directed toward this type of problem.
Yes, and the most common class of medications used for systolic hypertension are in what are called the thiazide diuretic classes, what people often sort of refer to as water pills.
Water pills,
They got their name because of the, not of how they work, but because of the side effect. When people first start taking them, they often say, gee, I'm urinating a little bit more frequently. And that does happen, but it usually goes away after a week or two. And the medication actually doesn't work to lower your blood pressure by, you know, getting excess fluid out of your system. There's a different mechanism of action, but that's basically how they got named.
Okay, okay. I did see my doctor, and he mentioned the water pill.
Mm-hmm.
So, okay. All right. Well, I appreciate your time.
You're welcome.
Right. Thank you. Well, again, questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455, and email will-talk@illinois.edu. And our guest this morning is Dr. Jeff Swearingen. So if you have health questions for yourself, could be for somebody in your family, could be for grown-ups, could be for kids, whatever happens to be on your mind, you can give us a call, and he will do his best. You know, here's something I was going to ask you about that I thought was kind of interesting. It's a recent survey, and it has to do with gout. And it notes, well, first of all, it notes that something like 5 million Americans have it, suffer from it. So for those people who think it's something from, you know, Charles Dickens' time, no, people still do get it.
But yes, they do. Unhappy when they get it.
Well, that's what's really striking about this, because the people in the survey, a lot of people said it can be extremely painful, and yet somehow people who have the condition and who talk about the pain say that when other people hear them talking about it, they apparently don't. They say when they talk about their pain, their pain is not taken seriously, as if people, I don't know if it's people believe that they don't understand how painful it can be, or they don't understand that it's an actual real condition, or what's your experience with patients and gout?
Most individuals who come in with a gout attack, basically, well, the most common place for them to have the inflammation, and it occurs in a joint, is in the big toe. Right. And for some reason, the general public thinks toes are funny, I guess. I don't know. But nobody takes it terribly seriously other than the person who's suffering from it. But it literally feels like somebody set your toe on fire. People will complain bitterly that the weight of the sheet on their bed at night, you know, killed them. It's that exquisitely tender to touch. And it's basically an inflammatory response where a chemical called uric acid ends up being deposited in that particular joint, and it sets off an intense arthritic complaint. There are medications to reduce the inflammation acutely, and then there are oftentimes medications used to try and reduce the amount of uric acid in that person's system so that they're less likely to have recurrent attacks of gout. And occasionally, going back to the thiazide class of diuretics, there are medications whose side effects are associated with increased uric acid, and the thiazides are one of those classes of medications.
So I just think about gout, and again, I suppose you think about the 19th century, maybe, and the idea that first of all, this was something that rich people got.
Because you could afford to eat and drink too well.
Yes.
And yes, there are some dietary indiscretions that seem to trigger gout, too much alcohol, too much red meat. There are certain foods that contain substances called purines, which the vast majority of people do not overeat because they're kind of odd things to eat. But in some instances, you know, somebody will precipitate their own attack. The old phrase, wine, women, and song, was attributed to guys who suffered from gout. And so I think that's part of the history of why other folks don't seem terribly sympathetic when somebody gets it.
Well, but it also can, it sounds as if maybe you could have what would seem to be to you to be a relatively normal diet and not necessarily overindulge in things, and you could still end up with gout.
And because, like a lot of medical conditions, there's often an inherited tendency. This is something that actually tends to run in families. And something about their metabolism of production or excretion of uric acid is different, and they somehow accumulate more of it than other people. And if you have more of it floating around in your system, it's not impossible for it to end up being deposited in one of the joints.
Right. And that's just something, though, that can be addressed relatively easily mostly with medication, or does that you also take a look at the person's diet?
Oh, we'll give them the standard instructions relative to purines in their diet, but most people look at the sheet and go, I don't eat any of that stuff. And so that's rarely the cause. If somebody has, you know, one gout attack once every 5 years and they know what precipitated it, you know, we would probably say, fine, you know, don't do that. It's probably not worth being on medication every single day. But if somebody says, you know, every other week I'm getting, you know, flare-ups, and at that point, putting somebody on medication to try and prevent that is probably reasonable.
Okay. To another caller here, Champaign County, line number one. Hello.
Hi. I have a rather prosaic question. I've never had a sty in my life, and I have one now, and I have coverage, so I can go in for a convenient care visit for this, and I've done that, and it's been pretty persistent. It went away and flared up. I'm using a sulfa drug kind of ointment from the doctor and compresses, and I've used tea tree oil, and I've been asking people about home remedies, and I'm wondering whether a boric acid compress is in any way would be dangerous. And then I have a general question, and I hope it's not related, which is, in your general practice, what's up with community-acquired MRSA?
Well, going for the first one, the sty usually represents just a little bit of a blockage in one of the glands that secretes fluid around your eye. They will become inflamed, sometimes secondarily infected, so antibiotic ointments or eye drops commonly used, but in most instances, just the warm compress, and it's probably the heat and not necessarily what, you know, chemical you're putting in the compress, seems to help open them up. In a few instances where somebody has just can't get one to settle down or it's frequently recurrent, one of the ophthalmologists can surgically excise the little gland that constantly is getting blocked. So in most instances, what you've done so far sounds, you know, perfectly appropriate, but if it's not resolving it, then chatting with an ophthalmologist about whether some type of procedure to get it to drain better, that would probably be the next step. Regarding MRSA, methicillin-resistant Staph aureus, a particular type of bacteria that doesn't seem to respond well to some of the common penicillin-type antibiotics. This is a fairly common problem, oftentimes in the past in the hospital setting, but as you allude to, now more commonly seen in the community setting as well. And yes, we are seeing more of it, and it simply requires a little bit more diligence, perhaps on our part, that when somebody comes in with a skin condition that we think about this, and if we culture a rash or infected area on the skin, we can alert the lab to check for this. Fortunately, some other types of antibiotics will usually allow things to settle back down. So we don't typically see these getting really, really out of hand. Most of them are localized infections in the skin that will simply respond to a different type of antibiotic. The really small collections of infection oftentimes will respond very well to just drainage. We will open them up and drain them. And again, kind of like with the warm compress, trying to get things to come to the outside and drain out.
Okay, thank you.
All right. Next is someone in Chicago. Line number four. Hello.
Hello. I have a question on regarding what you were saying earlier about the blood pressure, where it, you know, over the long run leads to damaging the vessels and the arteries. I'm just wondering what you think of taking vitamin C, not so much to lower blood pressure, but it's said to strengthen the walls of your arteries and your, you know, vessels. And I'm just wondering if you think that's a good idea.
The pros and cons of vitamin C supplementation have been debated now probably for a few decades, ever since Linus Pauling came out with his recommendation for it. There are probably some beneficial effects on endothelial function, that lining of the blood vessel with some additional vitamin C. But how much, for how long, for a given individual, I'm certainly not currently aware of any sort of hard and fast dosing recommendation for that purpose, and probably isn't going to, as you mentioned, supplant the need for something to control blood pressure. So if somebody says, you know, I want to take a vitamin C supplement, if they don't have any other, you know, reason not to, I certainly don't have any objection to it, but I don't have any good long-term data that says it's going to be, you know, the best thing since sliced bread.
Okay, thanks a lot.
All right, thank you. We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus with Dr. Jeff Swearingen from Carl in Urbana. You have general health care questions, call us 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. You may email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. Just last week on the program, we had one of your colleagues from Carl on the program, a dermatologist, and we were talking about sun exposure and things like that. And one of the things we just kind of mentioned was the fact that there are some medications that can make you more sensitive to sun. And I was thinking about the fact that when you go and you have your prescription filled, you get a piece of paper that has information about the medication, how you're supposed to take it, potential side effects, all that kind of stuff. And I started wondering to myself, and how many people, when they get that, say thank you very much, and they don't even read it.
Well, that's one end of the spectrum. The other end of the spectrum are the people who read the entire thing and then don't want to take the medicine. So, well, we have problems at either end. The Food and Drug Administration basically solicits any type of feedback about any medication and any potential adverse reaction to it. And some of the reports, as they come in, you start to see sort of a theme. And so if something occurs, you know, more than 10% of the time when people take a particular medication, then that's probably regarded as a fairly well-recognized side effect of the medication. But there are other reports where there's literally a single individual, and it gets listed as a potential side effect. So, you know, if you're walking down the street, just got a new prescription, and you know, somebody throws something out the window and it lands on your head, and you say, gee, I wonder if that's a side effect of my medicine. And you report it to the FDA, it gets listed. And so it's very, very difficult when you take all of those sort of single reports and list them all together to talk to people about, well, that's probably not necessarily a side effect of the medication, but this is something that adversely happened to that individual while they were taking a prescription.
Well, that leads to the question like, well, okay, so I get a prescription for medication. I haven't taken it before, and I take it, and I get a headache.
Right.
Well, I mean, that I suppose it could have something to do with medication, or I could just have a headache, or
exactly.
I could have diarrhea, or, you know.
Exactly.
So then how do you, as a patient then, how do you think about that, and do you call the doctor and say, you know, I'm not so sure about this, or do you just say, well, we'll kind of see how this goes over a day or two, or I suppose maybe it depends on how serious and debilitating your potential side effect is.
And also the seriousness or acuity of the process that you're taking the medication for. Okay? So if somebody has something minor and treatment was elective and they think they got a side effect, I would tell them to stop it. If they were being treated for something significant and what they tell me doesn't sound like anything that I recognize as a significant side effect of the medication, I would probably tell them, keep taking it. And in other instances, there are times where certain medications have certain side effects and you can actually test for it. You can look for some laboratory confirmation that this is a problem related to the medication. But in the vast majority of cases, the test to see if it's a side effect is to stop taking it.
See if it goes away.
See if it goes away and then reintroduce it. Again, assuming that the original side effect wasn't something life-threatening, and reintroduce it and see if it comes back. Now, in some instances, kind of like with the gentleman where we talked about fiber, if you're not used to something and you take a big dose of it, maybe that's just your body's reaction to it, not necessarily something bad or adverse. So in many instances with certain medications that are going to be chronic, we tell people in advance, okay, the usual dose is this. But for the first few days, I just want you to take a quarter of it. And the next few days, I want you to just take a half a dose. And then we're going to see if over the, you know, a week or so, we can get you up to the regular dose with as minimal side effects as possible. And so in many instances, side effects are, in fact, dose related. So if somebody eases on to a medication, they may, in fact, tolerate it better. It gives their system a little chance to accommodate to the medication.
Okay. Another caller here in Aurora. Line 4. Hello.
Yes, hi. I do apologize. I knew you were going to be on, and I just turned radio on. Hopefully you haven't talked about this, but it's in regards to kidney function, the GFR number, I believe it's called.
Yes.
What are your thoughts on that particular well, I don't know what you want to call it, but how function or how your kidneys are functioning or whatever, how that number comes to.
The GFR stands for glomerular filtration rate, and the glomerulus is that little part of your kidney, and you have tens of thousands of little glomeruli in your kidney, and they basically filter the blood and take the impurities out and dump them into the urine and then send the blood, now that it's been sort of cleansed, back to circulate again. So your GFR is a measure of blood flowing through your kidney. And there are certain values that are defined as normal, depending on your age and gender and size. And can be a very sensitive indicator of whether or not your kidneys are, in fact, functioning normally. Now, if you have a mild degree of kidney abnormality, you're probably going to feel fine. You're not going to have any particular symptoms, but it would be prudent to find out, if you can, what's causing the abnormality in my kidney function and try and either fix that or prevent it from getting worse. But this is standardly reported on blood tests now when people get a chemistry panel that includes their, you know, their sugar and their kidney and their liver test. The GFR is commonly reported with that and can be an early indicator of sort of kidney health and is, you know, a valuable way of following somebody's kidney function over time.
Okay. So, the reason I ask is because I went in for a full physical quite some time ago and came back with a low GFR, which the doctor was concerned about.
Mm-hmm.
When I went to see another doctor, he said, I don't like that GFR test, and he said he would rather use the other numbers. You know, I should have pulled my sheets. I don't have them in front of me. But as you well know, there's all these different
The other numbers you're referring to are called your BUN and creatinine.
Right.
And those are other blood tests that talk about kidney function as well.
And, you know, I guess they kind of looked at, as long as they fall into a certain range, then they kind of figure that you're okay, so to speak.
Right. But, again, if there's sort of an indicator that maybe things aren't quite ideal, looking for underlying reasons for why that might be the case. And as it relates to kidney function, the two biggies are blood sugar and blood pressure. So your hypertensive and diabetic patients are very, very commonly going to end up long-term with kidney-related problems if those two conditions aren't well controlled.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. All right, thank you. Well, we're about ready to finish up here. I don't know if there's anything in particular that you might want to mention to folks. Just it seemed to me that this past weekend was the first time so far this summer that I think that I remember there being a heat advisory.
Oh my!
Because it was really muggy.
I was outside and it was unbelievable hot and sticky was.
Probably good just to remind people, you know, watch your exertion when it's like that.
And make sure that you stay well hydrated.
Ah.
Because you can lose an awful lot of fluid and become really relatively dehydrated just from walking around in this kind of weather. And certainly individuals who have other medical conditions or taking medications that can be adversely influenced by that really need to pay attention.
And probably the best thing that you can do is just plain old water.
They really haven't invented a whole lot better than that. But, you know, if you like the taste of your favorite sports drink or something, I don't have any objection to that either.
Okay. Dr. Jeff Swearingen, he's a family medicine doctor at Carl in Urbana. He's with us every other month for the show. We call Talk to the Family Doctor. Thank you very much for being here.
My pleasure, David.